Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 15th of October 2014 at the Brecan Resource Centre located in Melbourne's CBD. What is vitamin D? Do I have enough of it? Why is it being talked about so much in the last few years? What is the data on cancer and other diseases in relation to vitamin D? And how good are the studies? In this session, Dr. Marco Honeyman will assess and present on the latest published results along with recommendations. Dr. Honeyman has worked as a senior research scientist at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research. We hope you find this session of interest.
So, first of all, we have to go into a bit of the heavy science stuff, just so you can understand the rest of it. But vitamin D is made in our skin from cholesterol in our skin. So if we're fitness freaks and we have absolutely no fat on our bodies, we're not going to make much vitamin D. So don't go out and run 500 kilometres a day, please. You need that cholesterol. We don't get much from our diet. In America, they supplement the milk and some other foods with vitamin D. But here, if you get a pill that says added vitamin D or a multivitamin that says vitamin D in it, it's not enough. You need to be taking vitamin D straight as it is. Now, how many of you have ever taken vitamin D? Ooh, good work, ladies. Good work. So what happens is in our skin, diet, you can get it from oily fish, but you need to eat about 5 kilos of salmon a day, which is not really an option. So turned into pre-vitamin D, and it's not actually a vitamin at all. It's a secosteroid hormone. It's like the footballers take. It's a steroid. Woohoo! It's not a vitamin. It's a misnaming. But you can see here that this molecule is sort of distorted, and the seco comes from the word secateurs. Seco means that little cut is there. And you can look and you can see that there's one hydroxyl here. Then there's a molecule that will convert it in the liver to this form, and it adds onto these. Each of these little corners is a carbon, and on carbon 25 another hydroxyl is added. So now it's called 25-OHD3 because it's got the OH on the carbon 25. And then from there it can go to the kidneys or wherever this molecule, the 1-alpha hydroxylase, exists, and it will add another hydroxyl on, and now it's called onto carbon 1. So now it's called 1,25-OH2D3. So that's the active form, but that is an extraordinarily powerful molecule, and you don't want it all over your body because it's doing so much. So mostly it's existing in our body and circulating in our blood in this form. So when we talk about vitamin D levels in the blood, which many of you have probably had tested, we're talking about this molecule here. The other thing to notice about this is there are ways of breaking down these things and peeing it away. But the other thing that's important to know is these molecules here are critically dependent on magnesium and zinc. So if you are zinc or magnesium deficient, you are not going to get the benefit of this. You are, first of all, you're not going to make much of this, and you're not going to make much of that. So the foods high in magnesium and zinc are the dark leafy vegetables, kale, broccoli, the dark leafy things, nuts. They're the main sources of magnesium and zinc. Or you cheat like me and you take magnesium and zinc. So that's what it's about. Now, the other thing is that, let's just go back. this will show you, this goes into the nucleus of the cell and it does very powerful things, and that's why you mustn't have that circulating. This sits in your fat. It will go in your blood, but it will sit in your fat. So if you become grossly overweight, most of it will be in the fat and it won't be doing things that are effective for you. Now let's talk about what does it mean by deficiency, sufficiency and intoxication. So deficiency here is when you've got these sorts of levels. Now if we look at papers in the UK and Australia, vitamin D is measured in nanomoles per litre. If you look at American papers, they measure it in nanograms per mil. The conversion is 2.5. But most of the time we can just look at nanomoles per litre. So 50 used to be thought of as a level of adequacy, and anything under that was inadequate. 75 is the number we're going for now, between 75 and 100. That's thought to be the optimal levels. But if you're a surf lifesaver, you can go up to 150 or 200 with no problems at all. However, there was a man who appeared with symptoms of toxicity and his son, and he had stupendous levels. He had diarrhea and he had too much calcium in his blood vessels. This is extremely rare, extremely rare. And it turned out that someone had put vitamin D in the sugar bowl instead of sugar. I think someone was trying to do them in, but it took them 5 months before they presented it to the doctor. So you can see 5 months of these stupendously high levels. They were actually getting about 100, they were getting 1 million international units a day. So this tells you that you can have quite a lot and it's not actually going to do anything to you. So just to be confusing, this is levels in the blood, nanomoles per litre. Levels that you swallow are measured in an entirely different way. They're measured as international units, and the capsules you buy from the chemist are all about 1,000 IU per mil. I advocate using oil, especially for babies, because there's a 400 IU in a drop, and you can just drop it and lick it, and you know you've had the right amount. You can also get the high-dose oil, and that is 1,000 IU per drop. So if you put a couple of drops on your hand and lick, then you don't have to swallow yet another pill. But the prices have come down enormously. But when we had ourselves tested in the lab, you know, being a good girl, I was never going out in the sun, I was 20. One of the young Greek doctors was about 15. A young Chinese PhD student was 10, and there's a lot of evidence now that a lot of Chinese doctors who go from China to the UK, they end up about 10. I came from Sydney where I had adequate levels, but once I got to Melbourne after about 3 years, I had grossly inadequate levels. Once I started taking vitamin D, the world is your oyster. So how does it work? So this is the active form, 125-OHD2. It can come into a cell, here's a cell, and it can do things at the surface of the cell. It can do rapid things at the surface of the cell. Or the most important thing that it does is it comes down to the nucleus and it hits the DNA. This is the vitamin D response element. It comes down there. This is a vitamin A transcription factor. So it comes down, and what it does is it turns on genes. Now, it's probably the most important to get this in utero when you're a fetus and in the first year of life, because we now know that there's things called epigenetics. Now, epigenetics is where you've got all those genes everywhere. You know, you've got 20,000 genes. Well, vitamin D can turn on 2,500 of them. So 10% or more of our genes can be affected by by this behaviour of coming down and turning on or off the genes. And if you get the vitamin D in utero or in the first year of life, some of those genes are going to stay turned on forever. There was an experiment done in Holland where they looked at the genes that were turned on in 60-year-olds because they had been born when their mothers were starved during the war because there was a big famine in Holland. And they compared the genes that were turned on in those people to their sisters and brothers who were born when the mothers weren't starved. And there was a considerable difference. And the important thing to notice is that difference had lasted 60 years. In mice, that difference can go down three generations. So that's the message I want you to give to young women. Make sure you have enough vitamin D when you're pregnant because it's very important.
Yeah.
How much? 2,000 IU a day is what we recommend. We'll come to that, yeah. So there are all sorts of effects. The main thing is, what does it do to calcium? It helps you absorb calcium from your diet. It changes your immune responses. If you don't get enough vitamin D in utero, you're more likely to get asthma and eczema. It can convert cells that are proliferating, cancer cells, into normal cells. So these cells stop being completely bizarre and haywire. But, you know, obviously that's not going to happen with every cell, but it's a very significant thing, especially in this context. There are effects in pregnancy that we'll come to. So what about, as we said, the cholesterol in your skin is hit by ultraviolet light. And what here's a map of the ultraviolet light in the middle of summer. So these are called extreme, and we get down to here, and we're still pretty high. That's okay. But in the middle of winter, look how different we are. We are in the very low level. And that's why it's very important in Melbourne that we supplement, because we are not getting enough. And the reason we're not getting enough is because the earth tilts, and the wavelengths that we want to 290 to 315, are less likely to hit us in Melbourne. They're hitting up here all right, but they're not hitting down here. So you get a lot more disease in Hobart, in Tasmania and Melbourne. So so the question is, what does that do? Well, here is the synthesis of vitamin D. And this is in North Queensland, this is in Geelong, and this is in Tasmania. So these are the effective doses of vitamin D that you get. And you can see that in North Queensland, you don't go for very long with low levels. And in summer, you're going to get nice high levels. But in Melbourne, you're going to have a few months where your levels are pretty low from the UV, and in Tasmania even more so. So does that mean anything to us? Well, if we look at, say, latitude, so here's the equator, and here's the northern hemisphere, and here's the southern hemisphere. Here's multiple sclerosis. You can see that it's much, much lower in the tropics and much higher as you go away from the equator. And similarly, for type 1 diabetes, which was my area of particular interest. So here is Melbourne here. This is our incidence here. Sardinia is a bit of an outlier. They're very strange genetically. They're quite different genetically. So there's genetic risk, but there's also this overlay of the UV-dependent incidence of the disease. So does that... Is it the case with breast cancer? I couldn't get any data on breast cancer by state in Australia. But but we know that, for instance, from the top of Australia to the bottom of Australia, there is a 7-fold increase in multiple sclerosis. We know there's a 4-fold increase in the incidence of type 1 diabetes. So I looked here. So is there a difference between the tropics and the temperate regions with breast cancer? And it seems to me that here generally this is more tropical regions, and as you go away you're getting further and further away from the equator. So it seems likely that there is a UV dependent change in incidence. But we'll look at this slide a bit later on too, because it's quite interesting for another reason. So it's likely that there is a latitude difference in breast cancer incidence. And do you understand the word incidence? That means the number of new cases per 100,000 people per year. So here, but I could find data for America. So here is the highest levels of ultraviolet here, moving down to the lowest levels of ultraviolet. This is sort of a dip here, but high ultraviolet to low ultraviolet. And here, for instance, is colon cancer. Red is the highest incidence, and or the highest level of mortality. Blue is the lowest level of mortality. So you can see there's a gradient, and these are the UV levels overlaid on it. So the lowest levels of UV go with the highest levels of colon cancer. This is white females with breast cancer, and you can see it follows the same sort of pattern. And so high UV, low mortality, low UV, high mortality. Here is uterus cancer. Again, the same sort of pattern. And maybe a bit more bitsy, the vaginal cancers and vulva cancers. But cervix cancer doesn't follow that pattern. It looks quite different, in case you think they all look like that. They don't. So this is a different sort of pattern. So it looks like vitamin D may not necessarily be associated with cervical cancer. So, who is most at risk? You're pretty well all white Caucasians, aren't you? Yeah. But anyone with pigmented skin is more at risk. So I bowl up to any ladies who are covering Muslims and say, do you know you need vitamin D? And they're so sweet. They're just lovely. And they generally say, yes, we do know. And we're told to take it. And now I bowl up to the Southeast Asians who are covering women. And once upon a time they would say, oh, no, we didn't know. But now, if I live at Parkville, and so there's a lot of uni students there, and they say, oh, yes, we hear this in our introductory lecture at university, that we should be taking vitamin D. So that, I think, is a really good thing. But there are other things that make us more susceptible to vitamin D deficiency. If we're elderly and we don't go out much and our skin gets really horribly thin, those with a higher education, because those are the ones who bought the message, slip, slop, slap, and don't go out in the sun, which, like me. More women than men, because they tend to go outdoors less than men. Workaholics, like I was before I saw the light, literally. Shift workers. You remember those women that were in the ABC in Brisbane? They who all got breast cancer. Clearly there must have been some infectious thing, because they were all sitting around the one table. But they were all shift workers. And that was the only thing that they could pin down. They shut the building down. They moved. I think they destroyed the building. Obese and physically inactive people, because as I said, they're going to suck up the vitamin D into the fat. Smokers, because one of the things that when you're patrolling your body with these white cells called macrophages, macro meaning big, phage eater, they're the warriors churning around our body eating things. Well, if you're a smoker, those cells are so busy trying to get the garbage out of your lungs, they don't have time for patrolling and getting cancer cells. and fetuses, infants, and those who are sun protected. And when I go past a school saying, this is a sun smart school with little dark skinned children wearing hats, I go, anyway. So, why are the levels lower today than they used to be? Once upon a time, we were roaming the savannah, getting about 10,000 IU a day intake from the sun. Then we became farmers, so that meant we could grow enough stuff to stay indoors in the winter. So we averaged, say, 5,000 IU a day. Once we hit the cities, all that shade, all those buildings, we're starting to stay indoors. So we're down to 2,000 IU a day. And now we never move, and especially our kids. 200 IU a day, that is insufficient. We need 2,000 to 5,000 IU a day. So it's interesting because you'll notice that from here to here, skin colour changes. And part of the reason for that skin colour change is our need for vitamin D. There's two sorts of melanin in the skin, eumelanin and pheomelanin. The people in Africa predominantly have this pheomelanin, but the eumelanin is down here. And is here. And it's the one that can change. It can get less and less. So why do we need less and less skin colour? Part of the reason is we intermarried with these beautiful guys, the Neanderthals. And they had been in Europe for 260,000 years, so they had had plenty of time to adapt to lower levels of UV. So they were red-haired and pale-skinned, and we intermarried with them. And they, we probably got speech from them too, because they reckoned that from the breaks in their bones, they were like rodeo rough riders. They had to deal with a mammoth with short spears, so you had to work as a team, and ugh, just doesn't cut it when the mammoth is heading straight for you and about to trample you into the ground. So we think that speech was probably evolved fairly rapidly in the Neanderthals, and then we picked it up from them. So we were all actually sun worshippers at one stage, if we came from Northern Europe. So here's a picture I took in southern Turkey. This lady is a sun goddess. She's got 8-pointed star. This is from the Lykian people who came down from the north because as the cold came up and came down, they were avoiding the cold and they came south. So, but they brought their sun worship with them, and it was probably the goddess Eostra, also pronounced Easter. So that's where we probably get Easter from, that it was sun worship. And also we developed halos within Christianity, and this is also in Islam we have halos. This is Yusuf and Sulaika, which is Joseph and Potiphar's wife, and he has the mega halo here. So again, the entry of sun worship into our current religions. And how's that for a mega halo? So the Hindus also came down from the north, and there was this mega halo. And here she is. She's a sun goddess. So that just shows you that people in the olden days knew a thing or two about the need for sun. And that we got the paler skin because the women who were darker skinned were less likely to be reproductively successful. They were more likely to need a cesarean. They were more likely to get preeclampsia. If you needed a cesarean 5,000 years ago, forget it. Or if you had a deformed pelvis because you hadn't had enough calcium in your bones, forget it. The randomly paler skinned women were more reproductively successful. So that's how we got the paler skin. So, what does deficiency do? In childhood, there's some evidence about schizophrenia being more likely. Certainly asthma, linguistic capabilities are much worse in kids who were D deficient in utero more likely to have type 1 diabetes, and certainly more likely to have rickets, which is, you know, the bendy bones. In pregnancy, it's going to affect us in lactation. It's going to produce more gestational diabetes, which has gone up like crazy in Iran once the fundamentalist regime came in and the women were more covering. More preeclampsia, more spontaneous preterm birth, more cesarean sections and such like. Adulthood, which is most of us, we're more likely to be obese, we're more likely to get cancer, and we're more likely to get multiple sclerosis and type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. All of the things associated with inflammation. And when we get old, and by elderly I mean anyone older than any of us in the room, cognitive impairment, so some of the people with Alzheimer's are just D deficient. Muscle weakness, osteoporosis, osteomalacia, pain in the bones, more likely to fall, more likely to fracture. And as you know, if you fall and you break your hip, that's not good when you're elderly. That's often the prelude to the end. So here's rickets. There's a little child in rickets, and that's going up in Australia. And here's, it's just going crazy, which is because people are not. Predominantly, it's in the Southeast Asian populations. For instance, a physio told me that in the Bhutanese community in Broadmeadows, there are more cases of rickets, and I had no idea there was a Bhutanese community in Broadmeadows. So it's a warning. So here's type 1 diabetes in Norway. I will get to breast cancer, fear not. Interestingly, this is the incidence of type 1 diabetes, which is highest in the world in Finland, but Norway's not that far behind it. It's about 40 per 100,000 per year now in Finland. But they had a policy of supplementing everyone of 5,000 IU a day with cod liver oil. And the dietitians got into the act. They said, no, you don't need that. So 2,000 IU a day, and then 1,000 IU a day, and now it's 400 IU a day. This doesn't prove causation, but it's a very interesting association, isn't it? And if they were supplemented, if kids had no supplementation with vitamin D in the first year of life, this is the level of type 1 diabetes versus those that had some degree. And asthma, as I said, was up. This is a study in Perth, and higher risk of asthma-associated phenotypes. So all those peanut allergies, egg allergies, and such like potentially could be avoided by making sure the mum has plenty of vitamin D. And neurocognitive development, more language difficulties in these kids if they were D deficient. Pregnancy, prolonged labour, twice the risk if they've got low levels, lower than 30 nanomoles compared to what we consider to be healthy levels between 50 and 125. And also more fetal distress. So one of the things it does, of course, is it increases your chance. Vitamin D increases your muscle strength, your muscle tone. Now, when you think about it, there's a lot of young women these days. The most athletic thing they're going to do is have a baby. And if they're D deficient, they may not be up to it, and they may have to have help. And so you get more cesareans, and the baby is having a harder time because it can't get out, and more preeclampsia. So if you've got good levels of D, you've got half the risk of preeclampsia. MS, huge numbers. They 7 million US military personnel, and the interesting thing is here, it was if they were D deficient before the age of 20, it could have been in the first year of life. And again, I'm saying epigenetics might be a really important clue here. That if you've got it early, if you've got enough D early, you're protected. That's why I don't like the kids not running around at school. TB is on the rise in Australia. Dark-skinned Asian immigrants have the highest TB rates. And I just want to show you this mechanism because it's very interesting. So here's the vitamin D3. It goes into these macrophages, these big eaters, and the TB is a sneaky little beast. It actually lives inside the macrophages. It's evolved to live inside the macrophages. But if you have vitamin D, it will make these things that will kill off the tubercle bacilli. So TB is on the rise here, but it's in the people who are darker skinned or the people who've come in and have been exposed to it as a child, like the Chinese doctors in the UK who are getting TB after about 3 years. So, and TB is a very significant part of our culture. It's part of our culture, and one of the things is it will affect people. So, for instance, there's a book. When you think about La Boheme, I had a nice picture of two young things singing La Boheme, and that was, of course, her dying of TB. And the picture I had, which I've left out, is he is actually Korean, the opera singer, and she is a beautiful black singer. And I thought, God, you know, because these people have come in from the country where they have been exposed to lots of open air and lots of UV, and they've been exposed to TB, but it doesn't hit them until they get into the city and they're in the shade and they're getting no UV. So I like that slide because those people would have succumbed to TB a lot earlier than even the white-skinned people. And the other thing is that there was a migration of African Americans from the south. They were field workers. Even though they'd been emancipated, they moved up to the north. And when they went into the north, they started dying of TB. And then there is a book called Caleb's Crossing. Does anyone know it? By Geraldine Brooks. That says to you that an entire culture can be affected by the lack of vitamin D. Caleb's Crossing was about the first Indian, American Indian, to go to Harvard and graduate and die of TB. And they happened again and again and again. So the American Indians never got to take their rightful place within that society because every time they educated someone, they died of TB. They came in from outside, they put on a lot more clothes, they were in the shade, and they got TB. So it's an important part of our society. So one of the things that it will control is inflammation and insulin resistance. And that's important because insulin resistance is the hallmark of type 2 diabetes. But it's you make all these funny molecules. And you can get insulin resistant in your brain as well. So if you're low in D, you're more likely to be insulin resistant. And it's been shown that sniffing insulin can actually increase your cognitive abilities. However, I am not advocating that we all go around sniffing insulin. Although I wouldn't mind giving it a try myself. So vitamin D is very anti-muscle inflammation. Now, the reason I'm sort of dallying with this sort of thing is because cancers can be initiated by inflammation. That the way you handle a disease, if it's pro-inflammatory, you set up a chronic immune response instead of dealing with it, getting over with it. Periodontal disease is higher, coronary heart disease, 1.53. So if you've got low levels, you're more likely to have coronary heart disease. This is just all showing that there's inflammation involved, and also flu. If you these are people who had vitamin D in the winter and without vitamin D, and with, so it can be antiviral as well. So if there is a viral component to any of these cancers, you're going to deal with it much better. Let's move on, because these things, metabolic syndrome, anyone got type 2 diabetes? Yeah. So you're less likely to get that. We'll keep going here. Okay. So the Harvard study showed that there were significant inverse correlations. The higher your D, the less likely you were to have colonoesophageal oral. Blah, blah, blah. But there's no indication of breast cancer here. But that was that study was 2006. And if we look at mortality rates, that's quite interesting because the black people are much more likely, the African Americans much more likely to be D deficient than the white people, mainly because it just takes them an hour to get the same amount of vitamin D it would take us to take 15 minutes. So, where are we? Cancer. So, black people are more likely, a bit more likely, to get cancer as well as other diseases. They're less likely to. And for women, where are we? Not that much difference between black and white. And you're more likely to die in intensive care if you're D deficient. So if we analyse that, putting all the trials together, every vitamin D3 dose decreases death by of any dose decreases death by 6%, but it's now thought to be more. Now, one thing I have to explain to you about D3 versus D2. D3 is an animal-derived vitamin D. D2 is from plants. Vitamin D is such an important molecule. It's in everything. It's in bacteria. It's in fungi. It's in plants. It's in us. It's in every animal. So, if you want to increase your vitamin D levels intake, you could actually take mushrooms and expose them to ultraviolet light, and that will up their vitamin D levels. But it will be D2, not D3. I, in fact, at one stage thought I should set up a business, and I thought, delightful mushrooms, that'd be the answer. And someone is actually making this to increase your vitamin D through diet if you don't want to swallow a capsule or lick a drop. So, prospective studies. This was a disappointment. There were... they started to look at all these things. High D was associated with a lower risk of colon cancer, but a higher risk of pancreatic cancer. Yeah, that's a bit funny, that. The moral of this story is don't take stupendous amounts. And pancreatic cancer, as you probably know, is shooting up through the sky. It's just the worst cancer, mainly probably because it's being diagnosed so late, because, you know, it doesn't have any sort of very clear symptoms. Prospective cancer studies. Now here we are. We're finally getting to breast cancer. Okay. 11-year follow-up of breast cancer survival. If people had good levels of D, they had only 0.63 of the risk. So their survival was better. And for 2-year follow-up, it was much better. But, you know, after 11 years it was... So they're about 40% better off survival if you've got D levels. And then there's this triple negative versus luminal. So triple negative, do you know what these are? Relative risk. So if you had a good level of vitamin D and breast cancer and you were followed for 11 years... you've got 63% of the risk of dying compared to someone who's got low levels of vitamin D. You've got, and they've got 100% of the risk. Okay, so it's a lower risk. It's 40% lower risk than if you didn't have good levels of vitamin D. And apparently this is particularly so in the triple negative cases of vitamin D, but we'll look at some more intensive. So you can see that all of these things did a little bit better. But this is particularly impressive, I think. So let's come back to this graph that I showed you before where I said, you know, people from the tropics were less likely to have mortality from breast cancer. But the thing to notice is that these are people who've come here from elsewhere. They are migrants. So to me, what that says is that it was important to have that vitamin D before you came. So, you know, we don't know when they came, how old they were when they came, but it was before they got here. So if you had good levels of vitamin D because you came from the tropics, or you weren't covering, or you had good exposure to vitamin D, your risk of dying of breast cancer is lower than if you're from Australia, if you're born and bred in Australia. So again, emphasising that maybe early is better, and we don't know how much giving it now is going to do. However, these are meta-analyses. These are other things. Cancer of the colon, pancreas. So again, 0.7% of the risk. Pancreatic cancer was higher, but there's very low numbers and low numbers of studies. So lots of diseases didn't show an effect if you intervened. Again, this might be because maybe you need to have the vitamin D early. And some of the studies, you know, there was all that association, but maybe that association was because people didn't feel well, so they didn't go out. So it was a consequence of the disease and not a cause of the disease. So a note of caution was then sounded saying, well, you know, maybe vitamin D is not doing all that much. However, this is the latest data now. So this is from October 2013. Early stage prognosis, early stage breast cancer prognosis, and the vitamin D level that you have. So they had about 6,000 patients. 37% were D deficient, so they had low vitamin D in the early stage of breast cancer, they had double the risk for recurrence and 1.8% risk for death. In other words, 80% more deaths in the people who were low vitamin D levels and double the risk of recurrence. That's a good point. I think but that doesn't mean anything. I think it's UK. I can look it up and.
So there would be quite a mixed population in that level.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yes. Yes. You can't say it's quite a lot of patients, but yeah. But I think that's a really interesting finding. That's new. And that, to me, says, have a go. Have some vitamin D. Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I have low vitamin D levels for a long time.
Really, yes. Most of us did.
I think.
Most of us did. I mean, I was 20. Now I'm full of beans, you know. Yeah. Oh, really? Yes. Yeah. Sometimes that can be a congenital, you know, you're born with it. Now, sorry about these slides. They're horrible, but they are this is October 2014. Now, just to show you that there's a lot of work going on in vitro, you know, outside the body and looking at cell lines and that sort of thing. Yeah. So this is just an in vitro experiment, but I thought you might be interested. I don't know, is estemazole here in Australia? It's a drug. I don't know of it. I'm not in the game.
Yes, it is.
Is it? Well, what they concluded, They used, it's mice, but they put a breast cancer cell line in them, and they looked at a breast cancer cell line, and they found that if they gave the mice both vitamin D and estemazole, it inhibited the tumour growth much more efficiently. So it may be that if you're getting drug treatment, the vitamin D may help it to work. So that's another reason, I think, for taking it. There's a bit of toing and froing about whether it's premenopausal or postmenopausal diagnosis. This one says that it doesn't make much. No, wait a minute. It's breast cancer risk by menopause. Stepwise inverse association beyond. If you were above 27 nanograms, that's 30, 60, 75 nanomoles per litre there. So if you're in that 75 level, which I said is the target level to aim at, there was an inverse association in postmenopausal women. So the more vitamin D you had, the less risk you had of getting breast cancer. That's that one. And this is another genetic type thing, because as I showed you, when vitamin D comes into the cells, it has to hit a vitamin D receptor. Now, there are some differences in the vitamin D receptors, and they can go down into the cell. But there are some slight differences, genetic differences, in the vitamin D receptor. So it's like the BRCA genes in a way. You know, there are some differences. And if you have this, then they're called... There's big F, big F, big F, little f, little f, little f. So if you had the little f here, that version, you got more, and you got breast cancer, you got more lymphovascular invasion, and the tumours were less well differentiated, which I think means they're nastier. Is that right? Yeah. So again, that's showing that vitamin D can be involved in how well you are reacting to the cancer. And this is another possible way that vitamin D might help. One of the things about obesity is a major risk factor for all cancers, or for many cancers. Now, if you take vitamin D, you actually lose weight, in my experience, at least initially. So, one of the things that happens is that when you go to sleep, one of the problems is we get less sleep these days, and you make leptin when you're asleep. And what leptin does is it controls how satiated you are by food. So if you don't get enough sleep, you eat more. And if you eat more, you get more obese. So they're saying there's this anti-leptin activity of the active vitamin D in estrogen-sensitive tumours in women in breast cancer. So that's another reason for taking it, that you may lose weight and that will help. Premenopausal breast cancer by the plasma D concentration. I'm sorry about this slide. This is low, medium, not too bad and good levels of vitamin D, and you can see that the risk goes down, the risk of getting premenopausal breast cancer. So it's about half if you've got good levels of vitamin D. Is that clear? Sorry, these are horrible slides, I know, but this is hot off the presses. This is like last month. So in other words, the risk of getting breast cancer if you've got good levels of vitamin D, premenopausal breast cancer, is half, 0.48, you know, half, 50%, if you've got good levels of vitamin D. And the more vitamin D levels you've got, the lower your risk. Have I still lost you? Okay. No, but it's helping me to tell you. Because I'm sorry there's no graphs with these things, but these papers, you know, are horrible. But this is really the latest stuff. So these are cell lines from normal mammary tissue and breast cancer cell lines. Yes, this is a note of warning. And that is that there are... Everyone's breast cancer is not the same. Everyone's got their own version. And the thing that's going to escape and grow is going to escape for a variety of reasons. So some of them will be susceptible to vitamin D helping, and some will not. So this is saying genomic changes induced by vitamin D are highly cell-type specific. Even in lines derived from the same tissue. So even in the one breast cancer, you can have multiple changes because these little beasties are escaping in a variety of ways. And that's how they're escaping the immune response. So it's not going to help everybody. Here's a German study which is showing that if you... As you increase your vitamin D levels, your risk is going to go down. So that's, again, for premenopausal breast cancer. And this is a goodie. Now, I don't know if you can see this, but this is distant disease-free. So this graph here is how long you can stay disease-free and free of... disease at other sites other than the breast. So it's metastasis. So if you've got sufficient vitamin D, that's the top line. If you've got insufficient, that's the middle line. And if you are really deficient, that's the bottom line. So that's very meaningful, I think. What that's saying is your chances of metastasis should go down if you've got enough levels of vitamin D. And that's in adults, you know, people with the vitamin D levels measured at that time. That's not talking about them having it in childhood. That's talking about what are their levels now. But overall survival with D levels, sufficient and insufficient is not much difference. But overall survival, if you're deficient, is down. So I think that's a really meaningful result. That's from 2009. Okay, so recommended dose is 2,000 IU a day in winter, at least. If you are deficient, you can actually buy 50,000 IU capsules from the States and online. BioPharmaCal, I think they're called.
Excuse me, my doctor actually prescribed it and you would get it from, say, Chemist Warehouse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 50,000.
50,000. Yeah, so 50,000, some regimes, they'll give someone 50,000 IU once a week for 8 weeks. And then you can go on to the 2,000. That's just to bring you up from the bottom level. Up to a level of sufficiency. So bear in mind that that sort of thing is prescribed. In England, of course, where they're a lot further away from the equator than we are, I went and asked at Boots for 1,000 IU capsules, and they said, oh, no, madam, you have to have a prescription to get your 1,000 IU here. Really? And I said, well, in Australia we can buy it over the counter. And he said, well, madam, we're a lot more careful here. There you go. And if you want further information, there are these sites, Vitamin D Wiki. Actually, it's all one word. It's not Wikipedia, it's Vitamin D Wiki. And you can look up and they've got all the latest stuff. It's a man sitting in his mobile home somewhere in Texas who is utterly obsessed with all of this. Good on him. You know, he's absolutely obsessed. And he trawls the literature and gets all the latest stuff. So that's a good site. And this one is Vitamin D Council. This is my friend John Cannell. And he's in Seattle. He is he's a psychiatrist at the Atascadero State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And he had a ward full of people who were criminally insane. But he can't publish the stuff because they're all black, and he can't say that, because you cannot publish a paper saying all my patients are black. But but a flu epidemic came through the institute, and everyone got the flu except for people in his ward, and suddenly he thought, oh my god, you know, vitamin D obviously works as an antiviral as well. So he got the passion. So he publishes nice little essays about the effects of vitamin D on all sorts of things. Or you can email me. And I think that's about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Margot. I was wondering if anyone had any questions they'd like to ask.
Do you want to point to
people? Okay, so Jen.
Now, I just read yesterday that there is a new sunscreen that will let through the 290 to 315 wavelengths, because the thing that gives you melanoma is the UVA, so it's less than 290. So I think it's called Solar D. So if you look up Solar D, and it's invented in Australia, I'm not pushing it, but I just read about it yesterday. So that would be worth a try. And also, I would say in your case, I'd swallow the stuff. Yeah.
Back there with that, it's been recommended if you are sensitive to the sun, that you just get 10 minutes a day of sun in those early hours of the day without having any sunscreen.
It's insufficient. It's insufficient. In winter, that won't do anything for you. So in winter, take some. Sorry? No. No, I mean, their recommendations... The slip, slop, slap type campaigns are driven by the dermatologists, but who take no account of the internal cancers. And this is an internal cancer. So I'm not saying avoid the recommendations, but I am saying it's insufficient, so maybe supplementation is the answer. Yep.
I'm trying to understand, I can't remember being told about vitamin D when I was pregnant, you know?
No, because this has only been around for the last 10 or 15 years. Yeah, yeah. That's why we were all deficient.
My
daughter,
who had children in those years.
Yeah. Because nobody realised. Nobody knew. Yeah. It's new. Yeah.
Just down the back there.
When you talk about daily amounts, what about the supplement, Fosamax has a once-a-week tablet for bone density to counteract the hormone therapy bone thinning.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
And maybe others are getting it once a week.
Yeah.
My vitamin D levels are up. Take supplements or...
Right.
Is something you get once a week?
Sure, yeah. There's actually a man in Sydney who... and I reckon this guy's a cowboy, but he's a doctor. But he is injecting, covering Muslim women with 600 IU in one shot. And he says, well, they come back every year because it makes them feel so much better. I personally don't think that's a good idea. But once a week or once a month, I think is fine. Yep.
Vitamin D,
I think, actually, I... I went through a whole lot of Malaysian stuff, and elderly ladies in, it was the elderly Malay ladies who were doing worst because they were darker skinned, and then the Chinese, and then the, no, maybe it was Malay, then Indian, and then Chinese. I think you should be taking 1,000 IU a day at least. Yeah. Or get out more in the sun. Well, in summer, if you're going out and you play golf or something, you know, you see the old leatheries there, they don't need it. They're getting heaps. But if you're not going out much, then...
I mean, I've been a sun lover all my life. As a child, we wouldn't have used sunscreen, but I was like,
yeah.
Yeah. My concern with my grandchildren, they are covered up and they're told that, you know...
Get the drops for them. Yeah. I think.
I've been told that it's vitamin D that's connected with vitamin A. So is there a special one taking them, maybe on
today? Actually, I take fish oil, which is vitamin, you know, there's a lot of vitamin A in that. It's not too bad because I don't know if you remember that slide where I showed the vitamin D coming in and going down to the DNA. That RXR is... the retinol A receptor. So actually, if it's hard to know, isn't it? You do need some vitamin A to go with the vitamin D to hit the DNA to turn on the genes. So I wouldn't worry about them saying that they're antagonistic.
Go back, Heather.
An IGP told me that it's no good taking calcium unless you take vitamin D to potentiate it.
That's right, but don't take a lot of calcium because... if you're taking vitamin D, because what vitamin D does is increase your calcium uptake tenfold. So I don't take any calcium tablets anymore. And I was pre-osteoporotic and a bit of osteoporosis in the spine. Yeah. Well, if you're on D, you should get enough. If you have yogurt or milk, you'll get enough calcium. Yeah. There's been experiments done where people have taken 10 or 20,000 IU a day for month after month and they haven't become intoxicated. And as I say, you can get up to the levels of 200 nanomoles per litre and not be intoxicated. You need to take 1 million IU a day. So it's not a big deal. Well, I just think the oil's the easiest way. Well, just get them up, get their levels up to 75 to 100 nanomoles per litre. Yeah, I think, you know, probably the younger you are, the more important it is because you can do something about it, you know. It's more important. Yeah.
I had preeclampsia.
Yeah. We're talking about preeclampsia, yeah. Yeah, and high blood pressure, yeah.
I had a caesar and all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. Is that connected to breast cancer?
No, I don't think those things are connected to breast cancer, but together they might be associated with low vitamin D levels.
How's it going with vitamin D?
Well, vitamin D levels, if they're very low, will predispose you to needing a caesar, to getting preeclampsia, and... perhaps also, as we saw with this new stuff, predisposing you to developing breast cancer, because colon cancer, prostate cancer and breast cancer are all associated with inflammation. Prostate cancer is more common in men who've had VD. Colon cancer is more common in people who've had irritable bowel syndrome, so there's inflammation. There's more chances of things mutating. Now, we don't know what the inflammatory stimulus is with breast cancer, but You know, those women in the ABC tend to make me feel, we know that in mice there's a thing called mouse mammary tumour virus. Maybe, I don't know, but maybe there's a tumour virus involved. If you, the question was, if you have MS, should you increase your vitamin D3? There have been... I'm sorry?
My daughter's pregnant.
She's pregnant. And
she's got MS.
And she's got MS. Yes. Really? Well, first of all, if she's pregnant, I should think she has to get good levels of vitamin D anyway. For the baby, if not for her. There has been, I don't know how many studies there have been on MS and vitamin D, but it hasn't been all that helpful to add vitamin D to people who, although, with MS, there are various forms, as you know, and one of them is the relapsing remitting type. And that relapsing remitting form, the relapses usually occur at the end of winter, which is when your vitamin D levels are lowest. So that suggested, and as you saw from the thing about the equator and getting more the further away you got from the equator. But adding in vitamin D doesn't seem to have helped very much. But that army study shows that it might be important, the level you got when you were young. So it might have, the horse might have bolted. But it certainly won't hurt her to have vitamin D, and it will certainly help the fetus. So I'm not saying it'll help.
Do you have a preference for vitamin D drops or tablets?
I have a preference for the drops for children. Because, you know, you make sure that they've taken it there and they're not going to spit it out, sort of thing.
I'm not talking about children.
No, either is fine. And I used to hold forth about the price, because at one stage it was about $50 a bottle, which was insane, because I worked out that you could buy a kilo of vitamin D from India, you could make it up in olive oil, and even for allowing for the bottle, and you got 1,000 drops you got 365 drops at 1,000 IU a drop, it would cost 16 cents. So somebody is making a big killing out there. But the prices are now around $16 a bottle, I think, so it's bearable. Mm. What time of day to take it? We know that during the day you start out with low D levels because you've been asleep overnight and you haven't had the light, and then it comes up and it peaks about 4 o'clock, and as the sun starts waning, so does your vitamin D level, so it holds you. So not only is it coming up in summer and going down in winter, but it's coming up during the day and going down. So I don't know, maybe that means we should be taking it in the afternoon. But I always take mine in the morning,
yes.
So it's just easier.
I read that if you take it in the evening, you may not sleep, you might be insomnia. I don't know.
Actually, sometimes when I've forgotten I take it in the evening, it doesn't give me insomnia, and plenty of things do, but that doesn't.
Does that mean there's a follow-on for when you actually have blood to take it?
Oh, well, that's true, yes. Yes, the time of day when you have it taken is going to affect the levels to a certain extent, but it's not a stupendous change. You know, the ballpark is probably sufficient. Yeah.
I'd like to ask, is there a reason for why our body doesn't produce this vitamin D apart from the exposure to sun?
Yeah, because we are humans and we have evolved on a planet that rotates and gets the sun on it. So it's just a matter of evolution, that we didn't need to make it ourselves because we were always getting it from the sun.
Well, I think we make it ourselves because the sun helps it happen under the skin.
Yes. Well, we make it ourselves, yes, but we need the input of sun. Every other vitamin we make without the need for the sun, but we evolved on a planet that's got the sun and rotating.
I don't know, it doesn't answer my question.
Oh, What do you want to ask it again?
If we get a lot of sun,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Still, we do not produce that.
So, if you get a lot of sun, but you're still not producing enough vitamin D, so you're still low, even though you get exposure to the sun.
You're probably not getting enough sun. But some people have mutations in the vitamin D receptor, so they might be making plenty, but they're not. It's not working. Also, if you have liver damage, you're not going to make it adequately because you know it goes from the pro to the pre, and if there's something wrong with your liver, that's not going to work very well. And again, if you have if you're magnesium deficient and zinc deficient, you may not be making it adequately because you need those molecules to convert it through to the active form. No. Cholesterol. It's cholesterol. So it's not omega-3s or omega-6s. I don't think. No. This question is about a Nutribullet, which I've never heard of. I don't think it's possible to get sufficient vitamin D through your food. You can blend up or whatever you're doing with salmon, and you've got to eat 5 kilos of salmon to get it. Well, I don't know. You're the expert. I'm not. But if you were in America, you could probably get some sort of background level by drinking a lot of milk. But we are not supplementing sufficiently here. So I still think take it. Or go out in the sun. Do a spot of naked gardening. That's the answer. That's the cheapest way, but you might get running.
You mentioned it just like, is there any relationship between vitamin D and hot flushing? I find that once the sun goes down, that's when I'm going
full. Oh, really? Yeah. No, there's a million other things going up and down in the circadian rhythms. We once did a series of experiments on medical students. We had them in bed and we bled them every hour on the hour, and put their cells up with tetanus and nothing, and looked at what happened through time, and we measured them for a whole lot of chemicals that your T cells make, and everything went up and down, or down and up, you know. So we found out that we were bleeding everybody, like your question, we were bleeding everybody at 9 o'clock in the morning and testing them for interferon gamma, and actually that was when it was the absolute bottom of production of interferon gamma. And also seasonally, all these chemicals that your cells produce change with time.
Too much vitamin D
cause? Diarrhea. What else? Something to do with parathyroid hormone. Very low parathyroid hormone, yeah. But it's very unlikely that you're going to get too much vitamin.
I've got dangerously high vitamin D.
Really?
Really?
This lady says she's got dangerously high vitamin D and parathyroid. Really? Really, that's interesting. Well, you don't need to take any, all right? But all the rest of us probably do.
Thank you so much, Margot. If you could just join me again in thanking Margot very much.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Breakhand's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.breakhand.org.au.